And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest today is William Boyle. William is originally from New York, but now calls Oxford, Mississippi home. His first novel, Gravesend, was published in 2013, and a collection of short stories, Death Don't Have No Mercy, was recently released by Broken River Books. Now, in the stories in this collection, critical thinking skills seem to be in short supply.
Yes. Yes. I would say that's an accurate statement.
So why do you choose to write about people who are on the down and out?
Bad choices have always fascinated me. I just got into reading noir at a really young age, probably sixth grade or so. I started reading Jim Thompson and James Ellroy and Elmore Leonard. So I was always just kind of, and also watching crime movies. So I was always interested in people who made bad choices and bad people doing bad things to each other. I just think it's fun.
So how in the heck did you come to read Jim Thompson when you're in sixth grade?
I loved movies from a pretty young age, and I think the movie version of The Grifters came out around then, and I was just starting to get into books. I mean, I'd read books for school, and I loved writing, but I hadn't read real books that hadn't been assigned for school or something. Also, I liked Stephen King a lot. I think Stephen King was always he was always kind of preaching the gospel of Jim Thompson. So I think those things came together, and I wound up with a copy of The Grifters. So my mother she never said no to a book. And I said I wanted The Grifters, and I got The Grifters for a birthday or Christmas or something.
So you weren't some like Annette Bening fan from the early days?
No. I was watching a lot of movies already around then. I'd rent just tons of movies, and I liked Stephen Frears, and I liked John Cusack. So that was probably just one of the ways that the movie kind of came to me.
So your stories are all set in the more down-at-the-hill areas of New York. Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in that area yourself?
I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in Gravesend, Bensonhurst, neighborhoods of Brooklyn. So out near Coney Island. And, a couple of the stories are set in the Bronx, Throgs Neck section of the Bronx, which is where my wife's family is from. We lived there for a couple of years. One of the stories is set in Poughkeepsie, New York, upstate. I went to college across the river from Poughkeepsie, a town called New Paltz. So, yeah, they're all places I'm familiar with. But I grew up in kind of the outlying neighborhoods of Brooklyn.
So it was a pretty Irish upbringing you had?
No, I'm actually not Irish. My wife is Irish. My name is Scottish. My dad was off the boat Scottish. But I grew up not with my dad. My dad left when I was really young. I grew up with my mom's family, and so all Italian. I had very Italian, very opposite of an Irish upbringing, very, very Italian upbringing. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in like Bensonhurst, Gravesend, when it was still predominantly Italian neighborhood, and that's changed a lot over the last 10 or 15 years. It's now mostly Russian and Chinese immigrants. So I grew up with that side of my family.
Was it Bensonhurst where there was a lot of racial strife back in the late 80s?
Yeah, 89. Yeah, that's a big, I guess it was 11 or something. The Yusef Hawkins shooting happened in Bensonhurst. That was a kind of just a huge moment. I mean, obviously a terrible thing, but for me personally, it was just kind of a thing that made me think about things that I hadn't thought about. I mean, I kind of mark it as this moment where I really had to start thinking about adult things. It was a really tragic and terrible thing. I actually wrote an essay about that not too long ago. It was the 25th anniversary of Yusef Hawkins being shot and killed.
Now, quite a few of the stories kind of harken back to that time period as well. Yank Bird's idea for a book, 1992. Then later on, there's a story where they think about grunge music back in the day.
Right.
The title story of the collection, A Man Steals a Walkman, which feels like that time, too. So what is it about that time period that evokes so much for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is kind of this warped sense of nostalgia. I don't know. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and that's what I know. In particular, when I think about Brooklyn. I mean, I get my family's still there and I spend a lot of time there still, but the Brooklyn that I grew up in, that I lived in every day, all the time, was the Brooklyn of the 80s and 90s. You know, I went to college in upstate New York in 96, so I haven't lived full time in Brooklyn since then. You know, I mean, I get back all the time for my family, like I said, and I'll have stretches where I'll stay there for a few weeks here, a few weeks there. So that's the city that I know and that kind of lives on in this mythical way in my mind. So that's kind of just what I'm fascinated with. I mean, I'm not interested in writing about Williamsburg in 2015 or Greenpoint in 2015. I'm just, you know, caught up in this kind of other space. And a lot of the stories are early 2000s or mid 2000s.
Yeah, you do have a hipster getting his in one of the stories.
yeah, I do. But yeah, I mean, it's the time I'm comfortable with, I guess, in a lot of ways that I know really well and that I don't know, I like the things of that time. You know, I like Walkman. I like having a Walkman in my store. I like payphones. I like, you know, stuff that's kind of gone now for the most part.
And you said nostalgia, and it seems extremely appropriate to these stories because with the roots of nostalgia being kind of like a return and pain.
Yeah.
It's a very painful set of stories.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm interested in pain. Yeah.
In Yank Bird's idea for a book, my favorite line of the collection was, "He had a prune where most men carried a heart."
Thanks.
When you come upon a gem of a line like that, are you proud of yourself or do you start to get suspicious of it or how do you react?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't remember reacting when I wrote that. I remember that was a story that I wrote probably in a couple hours. It was a story that really came to me all in one piece. So it just kind of happened. It just kind of rolled out and that line just kind of happened. And I don't know if I thought about thinking it was a really good line or not. I just knew I wrote the story. I knew I liked that story. I had a good feeling about it pretty immediately, but I wasn't thinking about, oh, that's, you know, this is a great line or this is a, you know, it just kind of happened.
Do you feel reluctant in writing about writers?
No, not really, because I don't like when people say, don't write about, I mean, I always hear people talk about what you can't write about. You can't write about writers and you can't do dream sequences. And whenever I hear somebody say something, it just makes me want to do that thing or try to do it. So I just don't care. You know, I'm going to write about whatever I want to write about, really. So some of that story was kind of, I think, a response to that. I think probably I'd heard somebody say, can't write about writers. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to write about a writer. I don't care.
So in that story, the meat of the story is his brother comes home from prison. His nickname is Hands Down.
Right.
And is it Hands Down the Worst Brother, or how did he get that nickname?
I have no idea. It just happened. You know, I love naming. Naming is one of my favorite things. It's always been one of my favorite things. My grandfather always nicknamed everybody, and they were always random, weird nicknames. Like, he called my grandmother Mrs. Penna. It had nothing to do with anything. You know, it just was a nickname he made up. He called my mother the Fighting 69th. He would just come up with nicknames for people. That kind of made naming a magical thing to me pretty early on. So I just love that about writing. I love doing that in anything I'm writing. Yeah, hands down, just the story started. I had a character in mind named Yank Bird, and then he suddenly had a brother named Hands Down. That was it.
What was your nickname that your grandfather gave you?
He called me the boy for the most part, but he also called me Pinelli, which is, as far as I know, not any real Italian word or anything. It was just a nickname. Nobody ever knew what it meant, but that was something he called me.
Well, if he called your grandmother Mrs. Penne, wouldn't like Pinelli be kind of like a diminutive of that? Maybe
it was Mrs. Penna. So P-E-N-N-A, and then mine. Yeah, maybe. Maybe there was some connection there. I don't know. But he had a lot of nicknames that were just kind of totally random and hilarious.
Also in that story, we learned that Yank has put his brother in other stories before. He's
right.
About 10 by his reckoning. Now, did you have to think of each of those stories, or did you just recycle names of stories you'd had in the past? Or
those weren't stories I'd written or anything. I like the idea of just coming up with titles, too. I mean, it's sort of the same. It goes hand in hand with naming characters, naming fake stories and fake magazines is just fun to me, you know? So it just kind of rolled out in the same way, you know? So I was just kind of having fun with thinking about, I mean, I definitely written a lot of stuff in my life that I'm not proud of. And I just go to that place and I think about some of my worst titles and I didn't write any stories with titles as bad as some of the titles that he comes up with, but I just go to that place and I just kind of get ridiculous with it.
Now, he uses an old Royal typewriter. Would you prefer to use one over a computer nowadays?
I mean, I like writing on a computer now, but I had that typewriter that he uses in that story was the typewriter that I wrote on for a long time. Somebody gave it to me when I was in high school. It was just like a big, old, heavy office Royal typewriter. And I loved writing on typewriters. I had about 3 or 4, and I wrote on them all through college. 96 to 2000, so people were using computers obviously already, but I was writing all my papers and everything on my typewriter on my old Royal, and I loved it. I loved writing on a Royal. It was a pain. You know, I couldn't get ribbons, and it was old, and my ribbon would kind of unspool a lot, and I'd have to retype things, and it would just, you know, it was hard, but it was fun. And then I just kind of eventually stopped being able to get ribbons and gave in and got a computer, and it's much easier writing on a computer now.
And in the title story, we talked about the Walkman. A character just steals his kid's Walkman,
right?
For no apparent reason other than just the spirit took him at the moment. And it turns out that the Walkman, which is outdated in its own way, carries music from like the 30s and 40s with a lot of old blues and country on there.
Yeah, and that's another thing. I mean, that was a story that's set in the Throgs Neck section of the Bronx. I wrote that when I was living in that neighborhood, and I think I just kind of, I spent a lot of time when I was there walking around, and I just kind of thought that one day, like, what if there was a kid, this kind of mythical kid who was still carrying around a Walkman, which, I mean, wouldn't be unheard of in 2005 or 2006. It just seemed like an interesting setup for the story.
But then the very old music as well. So how does that kid in the Bronx get to access all that Southern roots music?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that was, I like not reading into that too much, I think. I like thinking about that there's this whole story under the surface of that story, which is based on that question. Who is this kid, and how on earth did he come to this music? Did somebody give him that tape? Did somebody make him that tape? Did he find it? Did he steal it? And we don't have an answer to that question. And I don't know if I have an answer to that question. I just liked imagining the source, you know.
What did you imagine? What was the author's imagination in this particular case?
Did I have a definite answer for that? I don't think I had a definite answer for that. I mean, I think I meant him to be some kind of hazy figure that we don't really understand how or why he's got this tape, just that there's some beautiful promise in this kid that Calhoun sees. And, you know, and that's all he's caught up in, is thinking about the promise. Like, what if this kid is somebody who really just came to this music and loves this music? So, I mean, I think if I'm in a hopeful mood and kind of feeling for Calhoun, I think that's what he was hoping for. You know, he was hoping that this was just a kid who was genuinely into this music.
And you do make a lot of references to music throughout the story.
Yeah. That's a pretty early I wrote that story in 2007, I think. I think I was doing that a lot in some of the earlier stories that I wrote. And I love writing about music. Some people have tried to make me not do it, but I always find a way to do it, I think. And that story in particular, I do it in pretty specific ways. Yeah, so there's a lot of actual, I mean, almost the whole track list for that tape winds up in the story in some way, I think.
Do you think the music that your characters listen to gives us an insight into them? Is it possible to determine personality through music taste?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I like to do it. I mean, you could tell me something that somebody's listening to, and it gives me a whole bunch of insight into their character in one line. And then you don't need to tell me a whole lot else about that character. I mean, that's probably not for everybody, but that's for me. I like that. And I like doing it. I don't ever put music in a story or in a novel just to be like, oh man, I'm cool. You know, look at me. Look at this music that I know. I really spend a lot of time thinking about what a character would be listening to and what that tells us about that character, you know, what they're nostalgic for, like in that story, Poughkeepsie, you know, these guys who live in this early 90s moment and never got past it, you know. And also I'm obsessed with mixtapes, which, you know, the title story is in part about. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the 90s and early 2000s making mixtapes, and I think that those are their own kinds of story collections, you know, and the choices that you make and the transitions that you make. That stuff is so fascinating to me. It's such a great insight into who a person is.
when David Joy was here a few weeks ago, in his book, it's about a meth dealer father and his son.
Yeah, I really want to read it.
But they both like Towns Van Zandt and Hag and folks like that.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I'd really like to see a character who listens to Bro Country be sympathetic and, and someone we could root for. He goes, nah, I could never do that. I would never like anyone that likes Bro Country.
Yeah. A lot of my characters aren't sympathetic, so it's not hard for me to give them people to listen to that I don't like. It wouldn't be Bro Country. I wouldn't even know where to go with that.
So a lot of your characters aren't sympathetic. What effect do you think that has on you, spending so much time with people that aren't good people?
I think it has a good effect on me, ultimately. I mean, I think that I kind of work out a lot through through these characters. I like that Louis C.K. is probably, he's one of my favorite comedians, obviously. Also just one of my biggest heroes as a writer, I think. There's some behind-the-scenes commentary he does. I think it's on his chewed-up stand-up special where he talks about, it could be wrong, it could be somewhere else. He talks about his stand-up routines basically being based on a version of himself that hadn't ever learned anything. And I think that that's kind of a place I go to a lot when I'm writing about these characters. Like, what if I hadn't learned this thing? How would I deal with a certain thing? So, yeah, I get to just kind of explore some of the darker roads I've chosen not to go down through these characters. And that's part of the great thing about crime stories and noir to me, and always has been. You know, I like a lot of these stories are about paranoia, and so I get to deal with my own paranoia through these more paranoid, kind of terrible people, you know?
Yeah, there was one story, Zero at the Bone, and it kind of seemed like an opposite spin on Richard Matheson's The Box story that they made the movie a few years ago.
Yeah. I've never read that story. I just see that the movie was really bad. I like Richard Matheson a lot. I've just never read that story.
When they had the revival of The Twilight Zone in the late 80s, they did that as like a little 15-minute.
Oh, really? I remember that revival. I don't remember. I remember watching that at the time, but I don't remember that one.
And my favorite of that one was Nightcrawlers.
Okay.
The guy that had was in Vietnam, and Agent Orange had made him be able to. His dreams would become real.
That's right. I remember that one. Yeah. I love Matheson. I've never, I don't remember that or I haven't seen it.
Now, in a couple of the stories, in fact, it's the last two stories in the collection, you have women who are paralyzed and basically invalids. They can't communicate with the people that are caring for them and interact with them. So what's the deal with that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in the first of those two stories in the neighborhood, it just kind of happened. I had that character going home with this woman, and it's just kind of when he got home with her, I knew something was going to happen, and I didn't know what, and that was what happened. And she had this sister. I mean, I think I'm haunted by a girl I knew who something like that happened to. Both of those characters, I mean, there are variations on what happened to them, but a girl I knew in my late teens, something similar happened to her, and she just kind of went into this state of paralysis. I mean, I never saw her again. I knew her before that happened, but I had family friends who still knew her and still saw her. I didn't know her that well. I worked with her. I was haunted by her story, I think. I think both of those characters are kind of variations on that for me.
I was putting my little literary theorist hat on. I'm going, is it to be a mirror for the men's inability, their emotional paralysis that they suffer from?
No, I don't think about stuff like that. This is, you know, I'm Flannery O'Connor fan through and through, and a Harry Cruz fan through and through. And I like characters who are scarred and disfigured. And, you know, I don't do those things to make some big statement about anything, but I mean, I'm interested in those things. I'm interested in the way people are hurt or whatever, you know?
And like Cruz and O'Connor, you do talk about religion in some of the stories as well.
Yeah, I do. You know, it's a big presence in my life as a kid. I mean, I grew up 12 years at Catholic school and have gone back and forth with a lot of that stuff throughout my life. So it's another thing I'm really haunted by. You know, I'm haunted by Catholicism in a lot of ways. I mean, just the routines of school and church and people I've known and the way the neighborhood works in comparison to that. And then, you know, view that all through the filter of being exposed to Flannery O'Connor and Graham Greene and Walker Percy and just kind of huge Catholic writers that I got exposed to in my late teens and early 20s. Yeah, so I guess it's something I'm haunted by and struggle with constantly and think about a lot. In a lot of ways, I'm just kind of can't get away from it. Yeah.
Do you think there's a difference between Catholic and Protestant writers and evangelical writers?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. That's not something I really have given much thought to, I guess, but I definitely do think that I can't think of off the top of my head a whole lot of writers that are labeled as those things in the way that Flannery O'Connor and Walker Percy and Graham Greene are labeled as Catholic writers. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if I have a good answer to that question.
Well, you live now in Oxford, Mississippi, and there's a large evangelical.
Yeah.
And some other mainline Protestant denominations there that make up the majority.
Right.
So, I mean, can you notice anything in the people that's different in terms of guilt and judgment and anything?
A lot of good friends I've made in Oxford who grew up in just a world that seems very, very foreign to me. I mean, I think there are big differences in the way things happen. I mean, for me, even, you know, growing up in a Catholic family and going to church every week, it was like I went to Catholic school and Mass was, you know, an hour every week. You know, it doesn't sound even remotely similar to the things I've heard people talk about in terms of, you know, growing up in Mississippi and evangelical church and youth pastors and Bible camps and stuff like that. It's also so foreign to me. And I mean, you know, I live in Oxford and I'm not, you know, wrapped up in that world or thinking about that stuff too much, I guess. But I definitely have talked to people about it and have heard people talk about it.
So when do you think you'll start writing stories set in the South?
I don't know. I wrote a story for this Mississippi Noir anthology that's coming out later this year or next year that is set in Holly Springs. That's the first one.
So how did you feel when you were writing that?
I felt pretty good. I mean, I'm never going to write a story about somebody who grew up in the South. Just wouldn't do that. Not to say it can't be done, but I wouldn't be the person to do that. But this story is about Northerners, for the most part, in the South. So I felt pretty comfortable with it. I'd spent a lot of time in Holly Springs. My wife worked there, and it came to me pretty easily, and it was fun to write. I'm writing part of this new thing I'm working on is set a little bit in New Orleans. It starts in New York, but it winds up in New Orleans. So those might be the beginning of me writing about the South, but I don't think I'm ever going to stray too far from writing about Brooklyn.
Your publisher, Broken River Books, usually has these great covers that look like late 60s, early 70s,
yeah,
exploitation or pulp novels. They even like weather the art so it looks like it's an old book that you just found in somebody's attic. But with your brand new book cover, it almost seems like a throwback to early 80s zine photocopy art.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's cool. I hadn't thought of that. I like that, though. I'd thought more like it reminded me of some of the New Directions City Lights covers that I really like, but I like that. It does look like that to me. Yeah, I love both my covers. I just got so lucky to be with Broken River and that Matthew Revert, this wonderful Australian artist, does most of Broken River's covers. There's a couple other people who've done a couple other great ones too, but he's just amazing. And yeah, I love both of these covers so much. I love generally all the covers that have come out so far.
When Jedediah Ayers' book came out, I went, wow, I love this book so much, and I can't talk about it on the radio.
Yeah. Yeah, Jed's got that problem for every book he puts out.
The collection is pretty short, 8 stories, under 200 pages. Why did you decide to keep it so compact?
I like small books, was really my thinking, probably. I knew I wanted it to be like an album, like a 30 to 40 minute album, you know? Kind of thought about it in those terms. I tend to like books that are kind of in the 160 to 240 page range. So I knew I wanted to do that. I have a lot of other stories that could have fit into this book, but these were the 8 that I thought worked best together. And I think some of the other stories can work well together in a different way. So yeah, I think I just was thinking I wanted it to be kind of short. And I thought these 8 were just really unified in a way that worked well.
Beyond their kind of ease and holding, why do you like shorter books?
Just a lot of my favorite books. I love George Simenon, the French crime writer. So many of his, what he called his hard novels, his psychological novels, are in that range. Jesus His Son is one of my favorite books, which is, I don't even know how long it is off the top of my head. It's really short, though, 140, 150, something like that. I don't know. I mean, there's something to me about, I think I'm going to bring it back to music for a second. You know, I like the punk rock kind of aesthetic of it. I like a 30-minute album that packs a lot into it more than I like an album that's trying to be epic, which is not to say that I don't like long books. I mean, I do, and I like double albums. I like all that stuff, too. I just knew that what I wanted to do for both my novel and my story collection was more kind of in line with that aesthetic.
In and out, and everybody gets hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Thanks.
Yeah. Slayer's Rain and Blood is like 29 minutes long.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Perfect.
Exactly.
So what did bring you to the South in the first place?
In 2001, my now wife, then girlfriend, and I had just decided to move to Austin, Texas. And we lived in Austin for a year, and then we moved back to New York. We were in New York for a few more years after that. But anyway, the reason I mention that is because while I was in Austin, we'd go to the movies almost every day. And one of the movies we saw was Big Bad Love, you know, which is based on Larry Brown's story collection.
Carlos Howard
directed it. Deborah Winger's in it. And that was my first exposure to Larry Brown. I hadn't read Larry Brown at that point. Yeah, I'd read Faulkner and I'd read Flannery O'Connor, and I'd already had some sense of the South as this amazing place for writers. But, you know, the day after I saw the movie, I went and I got Big Bad Love, the book. And Larry Brown pretty much, you know, became my favorite writer. So Oxford, you know, not because of Faulkner, but because of Larry Brown, Oxford became this really mythical place to me. I read all those books in a pretty short span of time. And then, you know, that led to me reading Barry Hanna. And at some point, I read Tom Franklin, and who I think was already in Oxford. And then I read Jack Pendarvis. And I started reading all these writers who had some connection to Oxford. So it became a place I wanted to get to, I think. The short version is I came to Ole Miss for my MFA fiction.
It seems like the new wave of writers from Oxford are from all out of town.
Yeah.
They didn't grow up there.
Nobody I can think of grew up in Oxford that I know who's there now. I mean, probably forgetting somebody, but there are varying states of how long people have been there. But, you know, for the most part, everybody's from somewhere else.
Because it just seems so odd. There's always the kind of myth of the small town in the South where you're just, your family's there forever.
Yeah.
This is just all nouveau.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's a great town. It's a great place for writers. Been there for, 6 years now, and I just love it.
Is there another novel in the works right now?
Yeah. I finished a novel a few months ago, a short novel, that I don't know what I'm doing with yet. And I'm working on another new novel, so we'll see.
So is it easy for you to let go of work? Say, okay, I want to do something with this now and turn it over to publishers and agents?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess so. I don't know. I struggled my first novel at Gravesend. I get tired of sending it out and I get tired of rejection and things like that. I like writing more than I like doing that stuff. But yeah, I guess it's not hard for me. I mean, it's been a pretty easy process in the last couple of years, at least anyway.
Is it hard for you to talk about your work?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to, I'm not a great talker. It's not hard for me to talk about my work, but I'm capable of hating myself and hating everything that I say. So in that way, it's hard. I don't want to say anything stupid, and I feel like everything I say is stupid sometimes.
Well, thanks so much for trying to conquer your fears today and talking with us. I really do appreciate
it. Thank you so much for having me, Stephen. I really appreciate it.
William Boyle is the author of Death Don't Have No Mercy, which is published by Broken River Books. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.